Okay, so last week we finished up our arguments for Old Testament reliability, and we argued, we did finish up, right, Daniel?
Yeah.
Right. So, an excellent book on that is Gleason Archer's got a 500-page book, Survey of Old Testament Introduction by Gleason Archer, Jr., and he gives 500 pages of evidence for the reliability of the Old Testament. And then he's got like two appendices, probably 5 to 10 pages each, where he just tears to shreds any idea of reliability of the Book of Mormon and the Quran. And just shows how historically unreliable they are. So I really recommend that book. Gleason Archer is one of the greatest Old Testament scholars of our era. So now we want to talk about the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts. And first we'll start with the manuscript evidence, the evidence based on the copies of the New Testament. And then we'll talk about the apostolic fathers. They were the pupils of the apostles, selected by the apostles to lead in the early churches. The apostles started getting older. We'll talk about evidence from ancient non-Christian writers and talk about a little bit of the ancient creeds found in the New Testament. We'll talk about them, what they are, and how they confirm the message. Then we'll deal with some of the additional evidences as well. So first, let's get to the manuscript evidence. For the New Testament, okay, we have, in fact, I should write it like this. For the New Testament, we have over 26,000 handwritten copies, okay? Now, this does not mean that we have over 26,000 complete copies of the New Testament. Very rarely do you have even fragments from the first century AD. But we've got 26,000. Some of these, like Sinaiticus of Vaticanus, are almost complete New Testaments. But others, like John, the John Ryland's papyri, a fragment, they usually dated about 125 AD, and it just has about the size of a postage stamp and has a portion from John chapter 18, Jesus before Pilate. Okay? Now, there are some scholars who argue that 125 AD date is way too late. Probably be better to date it around 90 AD. That don't expect New Testament scholars to jump on board with that. They don't like the dates being early. They're always going to date it as the latest possible date. But you have 26,000 copies, and you might say, well, that's no big deal. Hey, every time you find a copy or a fragment of something from some ancient writing, it's a big deal, okay? Especially when you get Homer's Iliad, of all ancient writings, Homer's Iliad is second place. They used to list it as 643 copies, now some say there might be as many as 800. But that's second place out of all ancient writings, okay?
Are those complete?
No, they're not complete either.
Right. Yeah.
Sometimes they'll even count as a copy. You know, there's a lot of ancient writings where we have no real copies. All we have are quotations of that writing in somebody else's writing. And that's good enough evidence that writing did exist and will be considered almost a copy of that writing. Plato's writings, okay, when you have 7 handwritten copies, and so, you know, the New Testament by far has the most of all ancient writings, the most copies. When you look at the You have the number of copies. Let's see how I handle it here. Okay, then the earliest copy for the New Testament, you know, do we have any fragment that goes, what's the earliest fragment that we have? I'll give the 25 to 35 years. That's the John Ryland's fragment, supposedly written. The copy was, that copy would have been made probably within 25 to 35 years after John supposedly wrote the gospel, okay? If we take an earlier date, okay, if rather than saying it was written in 135 AD, if we take the earlier date like 90 AD, I'm still okay with the 25 to 35 year, because I actually think that John's gospel may have been written as early as the mid-50s AD. Princeton scholar James Charlesworth argues for a 50s AD date of John's gospel. So you'll see my hijacking the historical Jesus. I argue for a redating of the New Testament books. And I think you could make a case for all 27 books being written before 70 AD. Although it's possible that the book of Revelation, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and maybe Jude, might have been written after 70 AD. But there's some reasons why I would push all of those books before 70 AD. We'll talk about that when we get to the Apostolic Fathers. This is not stuff, you know. I don't want to make waves, but most evangelical, Bible-believing defenders of the faith, Christian apologists, just accept what they've been taught. And usually what they've been taught is coming from a guy who was trained by New Testament scholars who may have accepted the latest dates possible and stuff like that. But I wish Christian apologists had a little bit more courage to question what they've been taught, because I actually think our arguments could be a lot stronger if we question some of the things we're taught. I see no reason why the early church would have gotten the authors of the Gospels wrong and the order that the Gospels were written wrong. And so today we have a situation where almost every evangelical pastor teaches, you know, that Mark wrote first. Well, I wouldn't say almost every, but most evangelical pastors, Mark wrote first, Matthew and Luke borrowed from him, and the early church said, no, Matthew wrote first, and he was an eyewitness. Mark and Luke wrote a little bit later, and then John wrote after that. And but whatever the case, we'll see why we can push some of these books back. Here's a name for, the guy died about 10 years ago. Karsten B. Thede, British scholar. He was a papyrologist, which means he's an expert on identifying and dating ancient fragments. Okay? And Karsten P. Thede believed in the Dead Sea Scrolls. What was it? Was it Cave 7 or Cave 4? I can't remember which cave, but there's only one cave that has Greek writings in it, and little fragments, and he believes he identified a portion. There's a Spanish scholar, don't ask me why, but a Spanish scholar named O'Callaghan that identified a portion of Mark's Gospel, chapter 6, 1 Timothy, chapter 3, a few other New Testament fragments from New Testament books in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The problem with that is none of those fragments can be dated after 70 AD, because that's when the Romans came through. And everybody that was there either split or died. It was that they were en route to Jerusalem to devastate it. Karsten P. Thede also says the Magdalene fragment, I think it was of Matthew, I think chapter 17, he dates that back to between the 50s and 70 AD. I mean, so New Testament scholars are not going to accept his early dates because their theories don't have these books being written at that time. They had to be written much later. And so, but basically what I'm saying is it's possible that there's zero gap. We might have copies that are almost as old as the originals themselves. And but we have to understand this, that the same guys who are dating the age of these fragments are also the same guys who are trying to argue against Jesus of Nazareth being who he claimed to be. And so they want to push these dates back. They're just forced to push them to within the first century A.D. And we now have a mummy wrapping.
That's pretty recent, yeah.
Where they think it might possibly be from the New Testament, that they take a New Testament scroll to wrap the mummy, and it might date back to the 90s A.D. So whatever the case, we'll go with the 25 to 30-year gap. But it might be even less than that. Homer's Iliad, and then you got a 500-year gap. Plato's writings, you got 1,200 years. See, here's what I'm getting at, okay? How do we know that what we have when we read an English translation of Plato's Greek writings, how do we know that it really, really represents what Plato wrote, that Plato really wrote that? Let's say, look, dude, we got seven copies. Yeah, but those seven copies were 1,200 years, date to 1,200 years after the original was written. What if there were some lousy copyists during that 1,200-year gap? You know what these historians would say? Hey, just calm down. This is pretty good evidence for ancient writings. It doesn't get much better than this in most cases. So they're saying, calm down, relax, Plato really wrote this, even though there's a 1,200-year gap and there's only seven copies. But then you quote from the New Testament, you say, well, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Well, how do you know Jesus said that? Well, because John told us that Jesus said that. John was an eyewitness. How do you know John wrote that? Look, Fernandez, we don't have the original. So all of a sudden, it's a total double standard here. All this, 26,000 copies is not good evidence when you're talking about the New Testament. 643 copies is great evidence if you're talking about anything else. And seven copies, that's fine. Most of the ancient writings that we know about, we don't even have any copies of them. We just get a quotation from somebody else, or somebody else told us that the guy wrote it. So there's a double, vicious double standard there. Well, you also have the agreement, the accuracy. You have 99.5% accuracy for the New Testament when you compare these 26,000 copies. Homer's Iliad, you have 95% agreement. And they don't even bother. More than likely, the whole set of copies are written by the same guy, so they don't even bother given the stats on that. 95% looks real close to 99.5%. I ask my students, is that close? And they say, yeah, it is. But you got to understand, in textual criticism, 99.5% means that only five words out of every 1,000 are called into question. Okay? And because we've got 26,000 copies, you can usually figure out which guys got it wrong, okay? With 95%, you got 50 words out of every 1,000 that are called into question. So I would argue that 99.5% accuracy is 10 times better than 95% accuracy, okay? Now I'm going to give you a crash course on Bart Ehrman. I got this number from Bart Ehrman's old professor, the Princeton scholar, Bruce Metzger. And he still speaks very highly of Bruce Metzger. He waited for Metzger to die before he started writing his radical books. Probably because he didn't want his mentor refuting him. But Metzger says, here's the way Bart Ehrman will attack New Testament reliability. Bart Ehrman will say, when you compare the New Testament copies, there are between 200,000 and 400,000 variants, or variant readings or discrepancies, okay? And then he goes on to say, that's more than all the verses, than all the words in the New Testament. So he gives you the impression, if you're not trained in textual criticism, and he is, he and Bruce Metzger, worked on the translation of the Greek text of the New Testament. But he gives you the impression that every word in the New Testament is up for grabs. We have no idea what the original said. But that's not what he believes. But he'll, like you talked about, Pat talked about in his lecture on Islam, how sometimes he'll just omit something. That's what he'll do. He'll just bring up this and then just, and let you draw a decision, make a decision when you don't have the training to make a decision. By the way, all the problems that he points out, the real problems, are already in our newer translations. They note them in the footnotes. So it should be no surprise. If we just read our footnotes, we would be shocked by what he says. So what do we do with this? Well, first off, most of these are just misspelled words. Well, guess what? If certain copyists misspell the word, we can figure out who spelled it right. Okay? And then a lot of them are the movable new. Okay? The new looks like this. Kind of looks like a V. But it's like our letter N. Okay? And we have somewhat of a similar situation to the movable new, in that if I say a car, I have a car. But I could also say I have an automobile. See, because it starts with a vowel, you have to add an N. If it starts with a consonant, you don't need the N. So it's a car, but an automobile. Same way in the Greek. But some of the copyists, apparently Greek wasn't their first language. So some of the copyists didn't know about the movable new and just thought, oh, they misspelled the word here. And they removed the movable new, or maybe they inserted one where it shouldn't have been.
It's a grammar mistake, not a doctrinal
mistake. Yeah, not a doctrinal mistake, it's a grammar mistake. So you got misspelled words, movable news. Right there, you greatly reduced this number. Okay? Sometimes they're writing on, Bethesda or whatever, and they realize, well, no, they changed the name of the town to Bethsaida. Let me update it or whatever, And so sometimes they just updated the spelling and didn't mean anything bad by it. Well, that counts as a variant. Okay? You leave out one letter, counts as a variant. Okay? You know the only reason why we have 200,000 to 400,000, and by the way, that's a big gap. That just shows that he really doesn't know how many variants there are. But you know why we got so many? It's because we got so many copies. Okay? So all these variants actually should be evidence, good evidence for the New Testament. But the important thing, and Daniel Wallace points this out, great evangelical New Testament scholar, when you get down to the viable and meaningful variants, okay? What that means is it's viable. It's either in enough manuscripts or early enough manuscripts to where it really is a viable option. It might be what the original said. I mean, so many of these variants occurred so late, or even if they were early, it's just, wow, this is obviously not a viable one. The guy just misspelled a word or whatever. But if it's viable, it really has a chance of being, this could be what the original said. And then, does it change the meaning of the passage? There's some of them that are viable, but it doesn't change the meaning of the passage. Well, then who cares? Okay? That's like if you say John loves Jesus, There's something like 16 different ways, 15 or 16 different ways you can write that in the Greek. So does it really matter to us if you translate all the different variants there, you still translate it the same way in English? So if it doesn't change the meaning, who cares? And this is where Bruce Metzger comes up with the 99.5% accuracy. He's saying only 0.5 are viable, both viable and meaningful. I mean, if it changed the meaning of the passage, but there's no chance on it actually being the original, then who cares? If it could possibly be what the original said, but it doesn't change the meaning, who cares? And so when you get down to this, really, the only real passages that Bart Ehrman has, in fact, let me see if I can find... I think I'm coming up on it. Yeah, Bart Ehrman's attack. Yeah, the only ones that really mean anything are Mark 16, 9 to 20. You got to get the prelate manuscripts before that's there. So most evangelical scholars believe that passage does not belong in our New Testaments today. I disagree with them though. Because Irenaeus in 188, you can't tell me he had a bad copy. Irenaeus quotes, I think it's verse 19, and says it's at the close of Mark's Gospel. So I wish they would have paid attention to Dean Bergen's work in the late 1800s. When we went to the newer translations and we went to a new Greek text because of Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, Tregelles, Tischendorf, Westcott, and Hort were the ones who worked on it. Dean Bergen says, look, you've got to look at the early church fathers and what Greek New Testament they were quoting from. And once you factor them in, the majority of the manuscript starts holding a lot more weight than it does in the eyes of most New Testament scholars. That's why I use the New King James Version. It's based on the majority of the manuscripts, not just some of the oldest fragments that we found. I mean, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus are the two oldest, almost complete copies of the New Testament that we have, yet they disagree over 3,000 times in Matthew's Gospel alone. One of them, I can't remember if it was Vaticanus or Sinaiticus, one of them has so many corrections made to it that whoever owned this copy knew it was a bad copy. And every time somebody came to town with a copy of John's Gospel, they started making corrections. And a copy of Matthew's Gospel, they started making corrections. Okay, I believe that the reason why the majority text, based on the majority of manuscripts, that it got to be the majority because it was the most proven and most tested. And but whatever the case, so Mark... Mike was talking to me today. He's going to be teaching at a Bible study in John 7, 53 through 8, 11, the woman caught in adultery. That's not in the oldest manuscripts. Okay? Again, because I go favor the majority of manuscripts, I preach it as the Word of God. It's bracketed out in the New American Standard, and there's footnotes on it in the NIV, New International Version. But by the way, if the last 11 verses or so are not in Mark's Gospel, does that change your faith in any way? No. It ends announcing that he's risen. If Jesus never did forgive that lady caught in adultery, would that change your faith in any way? No. Let's see. Also, Mark 1:41. Some manuscripts read that Jesus healed a leper, or he healed somebody because he had compassion on him. Other translations say, no, he healed a guy because he was angry, maybe because the crowd's disbelief. Does that make any difference in your faith? whether Jesus did it out of anger because the crowd didn't believe, or out of compassion for the guy, it wouldn't make any difference in my faith.
Still healed the guy, right?
What's yeah. that?
Still healed the guy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just like, is this the best you got, Bart? If this is the best you got, you just gave me more confidence in my faith. Matthew 24, 36. This is how deceptive Bart Ehrman is. Mark 24, 36. Jesus said, no one knows the day or the hour of my return. Only the Father knows. Not even the Son knows. Well, he didn't. It's not in that. In Matthew's Gospel, that and even the Son doesn't know is not in there. And so he acts like, wow. He never does in his entire book quote from the parallel passage, which is like something like Mark 13:30, where it is there. So in other words, even if Matthew wrote it down without even the Son doesn't know, let's say Matthew said, I'm gonna leave that phrase out because I know Jesus is God and God is all knowing, yet Jesus admitted not to knowing this, and I don't know how to reconcile that, I'm just gonna leave that phrase out. You gotta be selective. You can't tell us everything Jesus said. So if Matthew decided to do that, I'm okay with it. But the fact is, Mark didn't leave it out. So the full phrase is in Mark's gospel, yet you can read the back of Bart Ehrman's book, misquoting Jesus, and he never even refers to that fact. So at least tell us that it is in another passage. But does that destroy your faith? It shouldn't. And John 1:18, the majority of manuscripts refers to Jesus in that passage as the only begotten Son. The only begotten Son. But some of the older fragments say the only begotten God, or God the only begotten. So God, basically the only member of the Trinity who became a man. Either way, for either reading is perfectly consistent with Christian doctrine. And then 1 John 5, 7, and 8. Listen to how deceptive Bart Ehrman is on this. He is correct in saying this is the only passage in the New Testament that by itself teaches the doctrine of the Trinity. He's correct in saying that. What he's not telling you, though, is there are lots of passages that teach one aspect of the Trinity. There's only one God. There's lots of passages that teach another aspect. The Father is God. Lots that teach another aspect. The Son is God. Lots that teach another aspect. The Holy Spirit is God. And lots that teach another aspect. The three distinct persons. So that's why we call systematic theology, because it's not biblical theology. You teach the doctrines that the Bible teaches as the passages of the Bible teach it. So biblical theology, it comes right from the Bible in those passages. Systematic theology, you take different teachings from throughout the Bible and you systematize it in a coherent whole that makes sense, okay? So he misleads others by making it look like if there's no one verse that teaches the Trinity, then the Bible doesn't teach the Trinity. Well, the doctrine of the Trinity, the only reason why we came up with the doctrine of the Trinity is because we didn't want to stop every time we mentioned God and say, by the way, this one true God, well, it's three distinct persons, because the Bible tells us there's only one God. The Father's called God, the Son's called God, the Holy Spirit's called God, yet the three distinct persons. So the one true God exists throughout all eternity as three co-equal, co-eternal persons. It's a lot easier just to say the Trinity. Okay? And whatever they take down. By the way, this passage, even in the majority text, there's not good evidence for it. So there's good reason that this thing was added later. Although somebody's trying to tell me that it was one early church father seems to be referring to it. But I think that's the only one you can really make a case on that it should be removed. But by the way, what I've just done for you, these are the only viable and meaningful variations, okay, variants. And so, if you go to the New American Standard, these are bracketed out. If you go to the NIV, they're removed to a footnote at the bottom of the page. Okay? If you go to the New King James, they're in there, and there might be a footnote on this one. But basically what I'm saying is, the debate is not either Jesus is God or just throw out the whole New Testament. Bart Ehrman wants us to think that's where the debate is. You know what the debate is? The debate is whether or not the New King James Version of the Bible better represents the originals or the New American Standard Version of the Bible. You could have two identical twin brothers that agree on everything except one thinks the New American Standard was based on better manuscripts, the older ones, and the other identical twin believes the New King James Version is based on better manuscripts, the majority. I guarantee you, if they both interpret their Bible with the same basic grammatical, historical method of interpretation, they're going to teach the same essential doctrines. So it's not a debate between Christian and non-Christian. It's a debate between the Christian who uses the New King James and the Christian uses the New American Standard. Okay? In other words, it's no big deal. All Bart Ehrman is really doing, and everything said and done, is he's taking what we're already told in the footnotes or the margins, and he's blowing it out of proportion and stirring up a lot of fear and doubt in Christians who haven't been trained in textual criticism. Okay? But absolutely no doctrine is affected by this. Regardless of whether you favor the majority of the manuscripts or the oldest fragments that we have, the oldest manuscripts that we have, Jesus is still taught that he claimed to be God, Messiah, Savior. He said he would return, said he was going to die on the cross for our sins. He bodily rose from the dead. There's only one God, but there's one God is three persons. You get that no matter what variants you're looking at. Okay? So really, it's just like bringing up all these variants and all this stuff. It's, in the end, 99.5% accuracy. The only viable and meaningful ones are right here, and that's just the difference between the New American Standard Version of the Bible and the New King James Version. By the way, I spent the first... Habermas doesn't like that I teach from the New King James. He told me, he said, boy, no New Testament scholar's going to give you that. I said, what about James Borland at Liberty University? He was one of the translators of the New King James Version. He said, yeah, but there's so few of them. And so I said, so do I have to go to the consensus of New Testament scholarship to determine which Bible we're going to preach from? You know, just because the vast majority of New Testament scholars hold some, I might like it and say, okay, I can use this as evidence for the resurrection. Then again, I might say, well, wait a minute. No, I favor the majority of the manuscripts. And I've got some arguments for it, but whatever the case, does that mean that Habermas and I, because he likes the older manuscripts and the New American Standard, I like the majority of the manuscripts and the New King James, does that mean it's a debate between two guys from totally different religions? No. We teach the same essential doctrines of the Christian faith, and we have so much in common, you probably have to get to important doctrine number 87 before he and I actually have any real disagreements there. Okay? So basically, that 99.5% accuracy on the meaningful and viable ones, what's going to determine where you stand on those five words out of every 1,000 is whether or not you favor the majority of the manuscripts or the older ones. Okay? And by the way, most of the guys who preach from the New American Standard, or the NIV still will on Sundays preach a message from Jesus forgiving the adulterous woman, and will still preach a message on it. And they might say, these are not in the oldest manuscripts, so it might not have been there, but then they'll usually throw in something like, but there's probably good evidence that this might really represent what actually occurred in this. And very rarely do they just skip over it and just stop at verse 8 of Mark's Gospel and say we're done because the rest of it isn't the Word of God. But I would like to see apologists. We don't want, Christian apologists do not want Christian lay people to just blindly follow authorities because the authority said it and just leave it at that. So I don't know why most Christian apologists will blindly follow in certain areas, you know, and I think we need to question things a lot more. So getting back to this, also add this here. The New Testament also has a wider distribution, okay, than in the ancient writings. We probably have... out of the 26,000 copies, over 5,000 of them are in the original Greek. Then you got about 9,000 in the Old Latin and stuff, and there's many other languages. But you also have a wider distribution, so you can compare copies of the New Testament translated into the Egyptian language hundreds of miles away from, you know, ancient copies in Greek in Rome or in Latin in Rome. And so we've got a lot of checks and balances that you don't have for Homer's Iliad or anything else from ancient literature. Okay? So basically what I'm saying is, if you look at the manuscript evidence, the New Testament is by far the most reliable of all ancient writings. Now, famous New Testament manuscripts, let me just cover some of these. The accepted ones, you start at number 2, John Ryland's papyri. A fragment of John chapter 18, dated about 125 to 130 AD. Carson P. Thede argues it probably should be argued, it's probably even earlier, maybe the 90s AD. The Bodmer Papyrus 2, mostly John's Gospel, dates between 150 and 200 AD. The Chester Beatty Papyri, major portions of the New Testament, dated about 200 AD. I will say this, though, there is a Korean papyrologist, I mentioned him in my book, Hijacking the Circle of Jesus, that dated the Chester Beatty Papyri to the 90s AD. And that contains major portions of the New Testament. Okay. Codex Vaticanus and Sinaiticus date to about 350 AD. You have almost all of the New Testament in both of them, as well as some of the Old Testament, but those are the two favorites, Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, of those who like the older manuscripts. Sinaiticus, I believe, was found in the 1840s, and so it was a kind of a newer find. And that's the other thing, I don't... when they came up with the Revised Standard Version, see, they would... What Westcott and Hort and Tregelles and Tischendorf were supposed to do was take the English of the King James and update the English, and also look at the English translation of the received text, which is almost synonymous with the majority text, and maybe if there's some areas where we mistranslated something, get a better translation for it. They were not supposed to go to a whole new Greek text. And that's what they did. And even if you argue that today, in 2015, I believe the older manuscripts are more reliable than the majority of the manuscripts, even if you believe that today, you should at least admit that it was far too early for Westcott and Hort and Tischendorf and Trugalis to know that, because these were really untested manuscripts. You gotta have more than four guys looking at these manuscripts before you can determine how reliable they are. And Codex Alexandrinus, about 400 AD, almost the entire Bible. And Codex Ephraemi, about 400 AD, almost every New Testament book. The Dead Sea Scrolls, fragment of Mark's Gospel, in one of the caves in the Dead Sea area between 50 and 70 AD. Virtually no New Testament scholar is going to give you that because of their speculative theories. Okay, now, let me say this. When you have a speculative theory based on circumstantial evidence, and then a lot of your speculation, that should not hold as much weight as empirical evidence. Okay? And in this instance, empirical evidence is more than circumstantial. It's a fragment of the document. So basically what I'm saying is they need to take a closer look at this. And the Magdalene portion of Matthew's Gospel that dates pre-70 AD, we need to take a look at that. But my book, Hijacking Historical Jesus, if you get a chance, believe me, let me tell you, when Frank Turek was interviewing me about my writing that the book, God bless Frank, I love his work and all. But he said things that were passed down to him. But you got to go a step further. You got to question even what the good guys are teaching you, because the good guys might have got it from the bad guys. Now, if it came from the bad guys, that doesn't mean it's false. But you ought to at least check into it. And so, like, remember during that interview when I was mentioning Clement de Rome and evidence for early days, and he said, well, in case our listeners don't know, Clement of Rome, who's the Bishop of Rome, who wrote about 95 AD, his letter to the Corinthians. And I said, well, actually, Frank, he became the Bishop of Rome in 95 AD, and that's why everybody likes to date his letter to the Corinthians in 95 AD. But no law says you got to be a bishop before you can write a letter. And he claims in that letter that the temple was still standing. So, and he may have been the Clement that Paul mentions in one of his letters. And he had a job where he was delivering letters, but he was well trusted. So basically, there's no reason why he could not have written that. In early 70 AD, Peter and Paul are already dead. He says that. They've already been martyred. But he says the temple is still standing. So unless he's lying, it seems to me that a 70 AD... So what I'm basically saying is, no, I'm saying that any writing that Clement of Rome, any New Testament writing that he's alluding to or quoting from, had to be written earlier than 70 AD. Okay?
The temple was destroyed in
70 AD. Yeah. And it would have been later than when he wrote it. It was still standing. The Epistle of Barnabas. Everybody likes to date it 135 AD. Lightfoot and Harmer said, no, the Epistle of Barnabas fits best in the mid-70s AD, shortly after the temple was destroyed. So we got to question. Basically, you start pushing back the dates of the Apostolic Fathers, and it forces you to push some of the New Testament writings back a full generation. Okay? So please, if you get a chance, read my chapter on redating the New Testament. This is not something you're going to hear from. If we had 100 of the world's leading new Christian apologists in this room, there might only be 3 or 4 of us who are arguing along these lines. Now, for the other 97, they might say I'm a kook. Okay? Fine. If you want to debate the issue, I'll debate it with you, and we'll find out who's a kook or who's basically just accepting what's passed on to them without questioning a little bit and doing their own homework on it. So now let's look at the Apostolic Fathers. So basically, you look at the New Testament, the manuscript evidence for the New Testament, it is by far the most reliable of all ancient writings. But we've got evidence for the New Testament outside the New Testament itself, and that you find in the Apostolic Fathers and ancient secular writings. Now, the Apostolic Fathers, they were the pupils of the apostles, selected by the apostles to lead the early church. Now, let me say this. One of the Apostolic Fathers, named Papias, and we only have fragments of his writings, usually quoted by somebody else, but Papias likes to talk about the apostles, and then after they died out, the elders. So now, if he's an apostolic father, and they got the apostles, and the very next generation are the apostolic fathers, who are these elders that are in between them? You read Papias' quote closely, and he gives John as the one of the in the list of the apostles that he knew, but he also lists John in the list of elders that he knew. And I'm one of those scholars who does not believe he's talking about two different Johns. He's talking about two different ages. The age of the apostles, so two different ages, the age of the apostles, and then the age of the elders. And then came the age of the apostolic fathers. But if the apostolic fathers were trained by the apostles and selected by the apostles to lead the early church, these guys are the next generation. How could there be a generation in between the two? Here's my view on the elders. Most of the apostles, with the exception of the apostle John, did not live to be old men. They were on the top 10 or at least the top 11 wanted list. Okay? The elders were guys, were their colleagues who worked side by side with them. You could kind of classify Timothy as an elder, although technically he is called an apostle. It's kind of a second level apostle, whereas Paul was first level, had the same authority as the original apostles. But the colleagues, their age, their approximate age, their generation, side by side with them, they just had an extra 30 years of life expectancy because these guys were all getting martyred. John was the one who lived into old age, so he was in both ages, the age of the apostles, the age of the elders. But then, so the apostolic fathers are the very next generation from the apostles, yet there was a gap where very few of the apostles were still alive, like probably from 70 AD to about 90 AD, where very few of the apostles were alive, probably just John, but there were a lot of these elders. Some of these elders, you know who they would have been? Jesus' 70 disciples. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you got some big guns that are there with these guys, okay? So let's take a look at some of the apostolic fathers. Give you a few of their names. Got the Epistle of Barnabas. I don't think anybody thinks that Barnabas wrote that. Alex McFarland states that in one of his things, but I'm wondering if you accept the earlier date, the 70s AD, are there some scholars who are open to the possibility that maybe Barnabas, Paul's colleague, did write it? And I'm not really sure about that, but it's called the Epistle of Barnabas. You have Ignatius. He was the bishop of Antioch, of Syria. Why is that church so important? Anybody tell me the two most famous guys who came from Antioch, Syria?
Paul?
Paul
and Silas.
Paul and Silas. Paul and Barnabas, Paul and commissioned by that, yeah, that church. So this guy too, he wrote in 107 AD when he was en route to be fed to wild beasts. He wrote seven letters. Over and over again, he's calling Jesus God, my God and Savior Jesus Christ. Yet he's arguing for Jesus' humanity, because there was the Docetist heresy which denied Jesus' humanity. So he's not even arguing for Jesus' deity. It's just he knows, they're going to throw me to wild beasts, and then I'm going to meet Jesus face to face. So as he's writing, you have these eruptions of worship. He can't stop calling, about three times a page, he's calling Jesus as God and Savior. He's arguing that Jesus really was born in the flesh, really was crucified in the flesh, really did rise from the dead in the flesh, really continues to live in the flesh. Because the Docetists said that the flesh, the realm of the flesh is totally evil. God could not become a man, so Jesus only pretended to be human. He's refuting that heresy. Epistle of Barnabas, written in probably the mid-70s A.D., Clement of Rome, most dated at 95 A.D., but he says the temple is still standing, so early 70 A.D. Papias, we don't know when he wrote, but he lived approximately about 60 to about 140 A.D. And you got the Didache. Just means teaching, the teaching of the 12 apostles. I would actually argue, most would put it about 100 AD. I would argue that it's about 60s AD. You look at the form, they still talk about apostles. The form of church government is identical. The 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, the elders and the deacons. And Paul was writing in the 60s AD. And you find that the Christians there seem to be Jewish Christians, and they're still doing Jewish practices. Like they're told, when you fast, don't fast as the same day on the same day that the hypocrites fast. Well, the Pharisees had a certain day each week that they would fast, and they're saying, no, don't fast on the, we don't want to identify with them, fast on a, well, who cares in 100 AD? 60s AD, yeah, you want to let people know that you're not one of the Pharisees. By 100 AD, everybody knows you're a Christian. Of course you're not one of the Pharisees. So it sounds like, you know, this isn't much later than James is writing. And by the way, they quote a lot, like the Our Father, and a lot from the Sermon on the Mount, which leads me to believe Matthew's Gospel was written much earlier. You have Polycarp, a pupil of the Apostle John. Now, he died in 156 A.D., but he wrote in 107 A.D. And he tells us he's writing when Ignatius is en route to be executed. You have the Shepherd of Hermas. And I think you could date that. Well, it's a tough one to call. You could go with an 85 AD date. There's something in it, too, that I thought it might have been earlier. But you could read my book, Hijacking Historical Jesus. But whatever the case, you just take three of these guys. Take Polycarp. Oh, by the way, he was a pupil of the Apostle John. And it was the last of the Apostolic Fathers. So when John was real old, he was real young. And he was the bishop of Smyrna, one of the seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation. But you take him, Clement of Rome, and Ignatius. Just those three apostolic fathers. Now, Geisler and Tarik refer to Barnett. I think I might have, too, in my book. But they put it down for 25 that he quote from or allude to 25 of the 27 New Testament books. When I looked closer at that, I only found evidence of 23 of the 27 books, okay? But they quote from or allude to 23 of the 27 books as authoritative. Does that mean the four they don't quote from were not accepted? No. You just had three little letters, okay? It just means they just happened not to quote from those in those particular letters. But pretty much what you get the idea that by the close of the first century AD, they already knew which 27 books belonged in the New Testament. There wasn't any question on that. We'll talk about that when we deal with Elaine Pagels and the Gnostic Gospels and see how important that is. But basically, when you look at the Apostolic Fathers, even if we accepted later dates for them, most of the dates would all fit within 180. By the way, this guy's not a... Justin Martyr is not an apostolic father. He's just an early church father. Yet he wrote about 150 A.D. So he wrote right at the tail end. So, I mean, you can even add him to the list of apostolic fathers, even though he's not an apostolic father. And you just look at what did these guys teach? You know, did they teach something different than what we have in our New Testament today? I'm really having a hard time with this stool. But no, they quoted from the New Testament. They alluded to it as being authoritative. They taught that Jesus is God. They taught Christ's deity, his sacrificial death for our sins. They taught salvation only through Jesus. They taught his bodily resurrection. There's everything that the liberal critics want to not really be from original Christianity, these guys are teaching. And, you know, who would know better? The Jesus Seminar, a bunch of radical anti-Christian scholars who come on the scene 2,000 years later, or the guys who walked with the apostles and were trained by the apostles themselves. So whatever the case, but what you get, like Ignatius over and over again refers to Jesus as our God and Savior, talks about Jesus truly dying in the flesh on the cross, truly rising from the dead. Polycarp refers at least one time to Jesus as God. Yet Clement of Rome and all these authors, Papias, refer to Jesus as the Lord. When you're speaking in religious context, please do not call somebody the Lord unless you mean God. Okay? And so in a religious context, they refer to Jesus as the Lord. Everybody knows what they're talking about. The Greek word kurios was one of the most common ways to translate the Hebrew word Yahweh in the New Testament and in other early Christian writings. So basically, they confirmed the teaching. So you got an unbroken chain from the New Testament, from the apostles to the apostolic fathers to the church fathers, right up until today. So don't ever say I'm teaching something new. I'm not. I'm just teaching what the apostles taught, as Pat referred to the faith once for all delivered to the saints. And then the ancient secular or non-Christian writings. These guys are non-believers, but even as non-believers, they taught us what. What the early church believed, okay? And so you have Thallus, okay? Cornelius Tacitus, a Roman historian, wrote in 115 A.D. You get actual quotes from them. If you go to Gary Habermas's The Historical Jesus, you can get quotes from them. I quote from some of them in my Hijacking the Historical Jesus. Suetonius, Pliny the Younger, Emperor Trajan, Emperor Hadrian, all writing in the early 2nd century, so between 112 and 138 A.D. See, what was going on was like governors like Pliny the Younger were writing the Roman emperors like Emperor Trajan, and asking, you know, what's the protocol on persecuting these Christians? And they're writing back and forth and giving advice to each other. And it was like, you know, look, if the guy denies that he's a Christian and denies Christ, let him go. He's not a real Christian. It's really crazy. These guys, the Roman government officials understood what a true Christian was better than the evangelical church today. You call yourself a Christian, okay, you're one of us. No matter how you live, no matter how you spend your time, yet the ancient emperors and ancient governors of Rome knew, no, if a guy's a true Christian, he's not going to deny it. So if guys are denying that they're true Christians and denying Christ, and they're willing to sacrifice to our gods, let them go. The guy's not really a Christian. Whoever filed a complaint was lying, probably just didn't like the guy. And but Pliny the Younger, I'll give you an example from him. He says that these Christians would gather on a set day each week before the sun rose. Well, they were gathering on Sunday. You find from the early church fathers, the book of Acts, even Paul talks about it in I think 1 Corinthians. They gathered on a set day each week before the sun rose. Why? It wasn't like they're trying to be secretive, although eventually they had to be to escape persecution. But they usually worked on Sunday. They didn't have off on Sunday. So they gathered before the sun rose, and they would sing hymns. Pliny the Younger tells us. They sing hymns to the founder of their religion as to a god. What he's saying is, the way we Romans sing hymns to our gods, that's the way they treated the founder of their religion. They worshipped him as a god. And he said they partook of very ordinary food, probably bread and wine. Okay? So whatever the case, when you look at these different historians or Roman government officials, we can piece together we can piece together this little puzzle about the life of Christ. And what you find is that these guys didn't believe, but they told us what the early church believed. And so when you get to Josephus, who here has a copy? You have a copy of The Atheist Illusion?
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you toss that over to me? Let me see if I can find a... Hopefully I can find a quote real quick from Josephus in here. I've got a quote from Josephus and no other gods, and I've got a quote from Josephus. I quote Josephus and I contend earnestly for the faith. And what Josephus basically says, he tells us what the early church taught about Jesus. And in fact, I'm sure it's in here somewhere, but chances are it'll be about 10:30 by the time I find it, so I think I'm going to give up on it. But whatever the case, Josephus tells us that there was this guy, he talks about Jesus called the Christ, and he starts talking about him. And a lot of scholars would like to say that that's an interpolation, that Josephus was a Jewish historian. High hired by the Romans. The Romans wanted to better understand the Jews because they just, it was just, the Jews were a thorn in their side. And so Josephus is a Jewish historian, lived from 37 AD, died about 97 AD, okay? And he's recording a history of the Jews for the Romans so they could better understand the Romans. A lot of interesting thing in his work on the antiquities. And, but he talks about the death of James, the brother of Jesus, and it makes no, and everybody accepts this passage. Well, it makes no sense if he didn't talk about who Jesus was somewhere earlier on. And so virtually all Josephan scholars acknowledge that Josephus did talk about Jesus, but how much of the passage they're not really sure about. Basically, in the longer passage, there was this guy named Jesus who was a performer of wonderful works, basically miraculous works. Many of the Jews followed after him and believed him to be the Christ. He was crucified by Pontius Pilate. But even then, his followers didn't forsake him because they claimed that he appeared alive to them on the third day after his crucifixion. And the tribe of Jews called Christians still exists to this day, and they believe he's the Messiah. That's the gist of what he says, okay? And the reason why a lot of scholars don't like that is because it makes Josephus sound like he believed that Jesus was the Messiah. Now, I haven't extensively read Josephus, but it seems like he talked to either eyewitnesses or as close to eyewitnesses as he could get. Because a lot of the events he records, you know, go all the way back to Noah's day. Well, he's got no eyewitnesses left. But he tries to get as close as he can to eyewitnesses. And then he just tells you what they said. So I don't, if he's going to record what the apostle said, it doesn't mean that he's committed himself to that. Okay? So I accept the longer reading. But even then, Professor Shlomo Pines of the Hebrew University found an Arabic translation of Josephus, and it has a shorter passage. So either a non-Christian shortened it, or a Christian enlarged it, but either way, there's basically no Josephan scholar who doesn't accept either one of the readings or the other. And the other one, just it doesn't say that he appeared alive to them on the third day, but it said they reported that he appeared alive to them on the third day. And but whatever the case, you have evidence from Josephus. So not only Roman and Greek historians and Roman government officials, you have Josephus. You also have the Jewish Talmud. Now the Talmud, Jewish oral tradition, okay, is the oral tradition of the Jewish rabbis in written form. The reason why the start date here is 70 AD is because that's when the temple was destroyed. So all of a sudden, the Jews are scattered and they no longer have a headquarters. And with oral tradition, okay, it would be like, hey, you guys don't have to, good news, you guys don't have to take notes today. Bad news, you got to memorize what I'm telling you. Now, the bad news for me means I have to be a much better speaker than I am. And so everything I say has got to be poetic. And so it's an easier form to memorize. That's why Jesus would say, ask, and shall be given to you. Seek, and you shall find. Knock, and the door shall be opened. I mean, it's like, whoa, I can memorize that. It sounds like a song. So much easier to memorize songs than it is Bible verses, unless you put the Bible verses to song. But whatever the case, the Jews would say, hey, since we're scattered, chances of us passing on all these oral teachings, it's going to be a lot more difficult. We need to start writing this stuff down. And so even though it was written between 70 and 200 AD, a lot of the teachings go back to the time, the life of Christ, and even before. So you get the Jewish view of Jesus, and they say he was hanged on the eve of Passover, by Pontius Pilate, and they refer to it as a mischievous superstition, and they refer to Jesus as a sorcerer. You know what they're admitting to? They're admitting that Jesus had a supernatural aspect to his life. He was a miracle worker. The eyewitnesses, look at the New Testament accounts, the eyewitnesses never denied that Jesus performed miracles. They couldn't deny it. It was too obvious. So they said he performs miracles by the power of Satan, Beelzebub. Okay? Then in the Talmud, it also talks about that Jesus was illegitimate. Well, what are they responding to the virgin birth? It shows the virgin birth narrative was very early because the Jews knew that Joseph was not Jesus' biological father. In fact, that's even hinted at in John chapter 8. The Jews are upset with Jesus, and they said, "We were not born of fornication." Because he told them that you're not really sons of Abraham. They said, "We were not born of fornication, sexual immorality, were we?" And then Jesus blows up on them, and it seems like they were implying that we've heard rumors that somebody here was born illegitimately. And no, it was the virgin birth. But you find the Jews, the enemies, you know, so people try to say, well, the virgin birth was a legend that came on the scene hundreds of years later. Oh, yeah? Then why did the Jews call Jesus illegitimate? Okay? Because the virgin birth story was there from the beginning. And so those are just some of the ancient non-Christian writings that basically, when you put it all together, you know, what Gary Habermas will do in his book is, the historical Jesus, he'll list like 30 or 40 facts about the life of Christ that you can get just from extra-biblical material. And so he makes a great point. Even if we didn't have the New Testament, we would still be able to write a life of Christ based on what early Christians outside the New Testament and early non-believers outside the New Testament wrote. Now what we'll do next week, we'll look at ancient creeds found in the New Testament.
Not next week.
Oh, not next week, the week after. And next Sunday is the Super Bowl. And after either a week of rejoicing or a week of mourning, we'll get back. But we'll talk about the ancient creeds in the New Testament, and then some of the additional evidences for New Testament reliability. After New Testament reliability, we're going to want to talk about issues of the canon, and I'll spend a little bit of time talking about the Jesus myth hypothesis that is not popular in scholarly circles, but is very popular on the internet, the idea that Jesus is just a myth, Jesus never existed. Very few scholars, I think Robert Price, Richard Carrier, they're probably the only two scholars who hold to that. And see, what you usually end up with really wild theories, you'll have like no historians denying Jesus' existence. But then you'll have some kid who denies Jesus' existence and hates Christianity so much that he's willing to go for 10 to 12 years of training to get a PhD in history. So he can become one of the first historical scholars to start spreading the idea that Jesus never existed. So, you know, but as far as the guys who actually work with the text, actually work with the historical data, I mean, there's nobody going around Greece saying, well, Zeus was here and he did this, and Zeus was there and he did that, Zeus was here and he did that. Let me tell you, if you're going on a tour to Israel, it is really difficult. And you want to just see the sites that Jesus, places where Jesus went, maybe a few of the apostles. It is really difficult to get a tour that only goes to about 15 or 16 places. Most of the tours would go to 50 or 60 places. So we went to one with only about 15 because of my wife's health. I don't want her to die out there. But the two pastors that were there besides me kept telling the tour guide, well, if we're going to go from point A to point B, there's two places we can stop in between. So they turned a nice, mellow 15-stop tour into like a 35-stop, 35 places that we stopped. So if Jesus never existed, I don't know what these tour guides are doing, because they can tell you where he healed the guy at the Pool of Siloam. They can tell you, yeah, this is where Jesus asked Peter three times, do you love me? They can show, here's the two possible places where he was crucified. It's not this one, it's this other one. And this is where he was buried and rose from the dead. And you can walk where Jesus walked. Yet, you know, guys out there like Robert Price denying that he even existed. You get a chance, listen to my debate with Mark Fulton on did Jesus rise from the dead. He's a medical doctor from Australia, I believe, that denies Jesus existed. And watch how easy it was to shoot him down. As long as I got equal time with the guy. When I debated Robert Price, it wasn't really equal time because Reggie Finley kept asking me questions. So I never really had time to deal with Robert Price at that. Maybe someday I'll get Robert Price a time debate. Almost debated Richard Carrier at UW, but I had another speaking engagement at that time. So, but whatever the case, it's real popular on the internet. But don't expect to get a job. Even Bart Ehrman's just wrote a book defending Jesus' existence, or at least a year or two ago. So the leading New Testament scholar that attacks Christianity, he's the guy you can go to defend Jesus' existence. And one of the things he says is that no fully accredited school is going to hire any professor that denies that Jesus of Nazareth existed, because it's not a scholarly view. There might be a couple scholars who now hold to it, but they're not going to get hired in the history department anytime. So you deny Jesus existed, you might as well be a flat earther, is what he's saying. So we'll talk about that too. All right, God bless you.